podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Network's 200 stations coast to coast on Sunday, June 14th, 2020. This is episode 1704. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast comes to you from TWiT's LastPass studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check it out at lastpass.com/twit to learn more. This episode of the Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Get 20% off plus free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code TECHGUY. And by LinkedIn Learning. A lot of things are changing in our professional lives. With over 16,000 courses taught by the best industry experts, LinkedIn Learning is where you can get skills like how to master working from home, entrepreneurship foundations, how to be a resilient leader, just to name a few. Try 1 month free at linkedinlearning.com/tech guy. And by LastPass. Prepare for the unexpected in your business with LastPass. Trusted by over 17 million users and 61,000 businesses worldwide. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. It's time, yeah, to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, all that jazz. 88 88 88. Ask Leo. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, internationally, you still can call us, but you got to use Skype Out or something like that to call that number. But it's a toll free number. Shouldn't cost you anything. 8888. Ask Leo. The phone number. Let's see. Apple's going to have an event a week from tomorrow. The Worldwide Developers Conference, which is typically in June, usually earlier in June. And, of course, this year will be streamed. Nobody in person. Be interesting to see if Tim Cook does what Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, did at their developer conference. He had a specially designed backdrop and bookshelves. And lots of Easter eggs, in it, including some, you know, mystery coding and all sorts of strange stuff. It was kind of fun for developers. You know, they love those puzzles to figure out what all the little things were behind Satya Nadella. I don't think it was probably Satya's house, but it looked very homey. And I wonder what Tim will do. Will he do it from his office? Yeah, that's probably what he'll do. I'm going to guess. But we'll see. More interesting, of course, is what Apple might announce. And there are lots of rumors. Apple, this is always a bad time to buy Apple gear, right? Right now. Because Apple, who knows? You know, Apple might announce something. And when they do, you'll be sorry you bought that thing. For instance, rumors there'll be a new Apple TV. Maybe. Rumors, maybe more likely that there'll be a new iMac with a screen that looks more like that high-end XDR display that Apple's selling for $6,000. that's with the stand. If you don't want the stand, if you just want to let it flop on your desk, you could save $1,000. I'd love to see somebody have this $5,000 monitor propped up with books. And you come in, they say, well, I couldn't afford the stand, so... I'm propping it. I'm leaning against the wall. WWDC will certainly announce the new version of macOS and the new version of iOS for the iPhone. iOS 14 and macOS, is, I guess, 10.16. The interesting thing for me, and I think a lot of tech journalists, you know, we're always looking for new hardware, but the most interesting thing Apple would announce at this, and I think they will, is that they are going to start the move away from Intel chips. This is huge, not just for Intel. Right now, all Windows PCs and all Macintosh computers are built around Windows chips. Some of the Apples have ARM chips in them as well, the T2 chip, but it doesn't run the whole thing, the whole show. And what Apple's looking at is running the whole show with their own custom designed chips, which would just, well, that's what they do already with the iPad and an iPhone. Those are all very, very custom designed chips that Apple uses for their devices. And as a result, they get better battery life. They get better performance. In fact, the iPad performance beats a lot of desktop computers. It'd be very interesting to see what Apple announces. I'm going to be watching for that a week from Monday, WWDC. IBM, Amazon, and now Microsoft have announced a hiatus on face recognition. IBM says, we're not going to make it anymore. Microsoft says it won't sell police its facial recognition technology. Amazon says a one-year hiatus on face recognition. Why, you might ask? I mean, there's definitely a useful tool for police or even just security in general. I'm told Taylor Swift, back when she was still doing concerts, would have cameras at the entrance to the concerts to look for, recognize, and eliminate people who'd given, you know, caused problems in the past, stalkers and unruly elements, that kind of thing. Here's the problem, though, and the reason Microsoft, Amazon, and IBM are turning their backs on this, at least for law enforcement, is the way they've trained it. Face recognition is a form of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is when a computer learns from the outside world how to do something, is trained how to do something with real data, and in all three cases, and I would guess in almost all face recognition, they train the face recognition, the AI, with pictures of people. That's a person, that's a person, that's a person. In fact, there's a company called Clearview AI that's been selling law enforcement face recognition for a long time. They actually, they're pretty controversial. They scrape pictures of people from the internet, from your Facebook page, from your anywhere you've published pictures of yourself that are somehow associated with your identity. Facebook's the best. Facebook said, knock it off. But Clearview said, well, we're looking at the stuff that's public. We're not looking at the stuff that's private. Do you put pictures of yourself on Facebook and other people, and do you identify it? You tag it with your name? Instagram, Twitter, do you tag it with your name? Well, you're basically helping build a database of face recognition. The problem with the face recognition that Amazon does and Microsoft does is it's based mostly trained on white people, Caucasians. And as a result, it's really inaccurate, especially with black people, people of color of any kind, but especially with black people. And there's a problem there because when it's not trained well, you get a lot of false positives. Now, the police don't want false negatives. They don't want to be looking for a suspect in a crowd and miss him. I don't know how they feel about false positives. But if you identify every African American, every black person in a crowd as a felon and you go out and arrest, that's problematic, as you might imagine. And we've seen it happen again and again. So I think it's not a bad idea. San Francisco has banned it. Other cities have banned it. It's completely, the state of Illinois has the most sweeping ban of face recognition. They completely ban it. And it's interesting because when a state does it, you could, I guess, in theory, get a, you know, say, well, not available in Illinois. You see that sometimes. The Biometric Information Privacy Act, which was made a law in October 2008. Wow. Ooh, I missed that part. It allows you to sue for damages. And I think that's pretty effective. Woo! If you can sue, oof, that stops people. Google was hit with a class action lawsuit in February over its face recognition, its biometric recognition. the statute, the law, which has been in law, I didn't realize since 2008. I'm just looking at it right now. Wow. Requires companies to collect and store Illinois residents' fingerprints, iris scans, DNA, or face geometry used with face recognition. Have to say how they store it, how they protect it. There's potential damages of $1,000 per incident for negligence, $5,000 for intentional negligence, intentional failure. Google apparently failed to obtain a consent from anyone. So they want, it's a big suit from anyone. How many Illinoisans, how do you say that? Illinoisianans use Google? I would guess most. That's going to be a lawsuit. The Illinois law was used to go after Facebook. Facebook agreed to settle for more than $500 million. They're still doing it, but they paid out. You know what? What it tells you is it's worth $500 million for Facebook, and that's the real problem. It's worth it. It's fine. Okay, here, have some money. They didn't stop doing it in Illinois. They just said we'll take the penalty. Thank you. I hope though that laws like that, laws in California has a new privacy law, the European GDPR law. I hope it stimulates companies to at least inform and request consent, right, before they collect that information. Let you know they're collecting it. Let you know what they do with it. And ask for your consent. That seems fair. But you might also think as you post that picture on Facebook of your friend and your neighbor and your niece and your nephew and you tag them, you might think what you're doing there is providing face recognition information to companies like Clearview AI. 8888 Ask Leo. That's why I like a mask. I mean, besides the fact that masks protect you, and we're learning more and more, by the way, they do protect you from the virus. That's good. If everybody wore masks, we literally wouldn't have a problem. It'd go away. People wouldn't get sick. And side benefit. They can't recognize you. Although my guess is, I bet they're working on face recognition that isn't hampered by masks. Your eyes, it's your eyes that tell the story. I look deep within them and I know you are you. 8888 Ask Leo website is free, open to all, techguylabs.com. Everything we talk about goes up there. Put some articles up there for the Illinois law and so forth. James Ruvo's writing as I speak, so you don't have to write anything down. Just go to the website. It's free, techguylabs.com. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the unbreakable Kimmy Schaffer. She don't take no schneffer. Hello, Kimmy Schaffer.
Good morning.
So we've been talking about the name for the next version of Mac OS because they had...
There is a weed, California.
Weed. Mac OS weed. No. So they had Mojave. They had Yosemite. They had Catalina.
Now, is Big Sur really a pretty name, or is it just because it's
Mac
so
OS
beautiful?
Big Sur. Yeah, maybe there. Not. How about Mac OS Candido? It kind of has a rhythm to it.
Mac
OS Candido.
Cucamonga.
Mac OS Oxnard. It's a California place name. They could branch out. They could do other national parks, I guess.
Yeah, they could.
Mac OS... Bryce. No.
Mm-mm.
Mac OS. I don't know. Grand Tetons.
No, that'd be bad.
That'd be bad. Mac OS Paso Robles. I don't know. I don't know what the. You
and
will
you
find
know
out.
They're having meetings about this.
Oh, it's
thing.
Probably fun for them. They have a vote. I bet they have a vote.
I'm sure there's booze involved.
Mac OS Disneyland. They would love. You know, Apple has enough money. They could buy, practice. Well, maybe they don't have enough money. Disney's worth a little bit. I bet they could buy Disney. There's always been a close relationship. Mac OS Disney.
Ooh.
New.
That's
Mac OS Mickey.
It is interesting to think about who has more money, Disney or Mac. I don't know.
Well, I think since COVID and the, you know.
Mac.
I think Apple's probably, you know, they're almost up to $1.5 trillion in market
people
cap.
People can still buy stuff. They just can't go to Disney.
Yeah. Well, and Disney Plus has been very successful.
Yeah.
Let me just check what Disney...
What's it's worth?
What Disney is worth. Oh, Disney's worth a mere $208 billion.
Okay.
You could buy Disney with the cash under Tim Cook's couch sofa cushion. He's got that much. Literally, they have that much in cash. They could just say, here's a check. Thank you very much. I don't know if Disney would want to be bought by Apple. I don't know. It'd be a good time to buy it, right? Figuring, you know, this is an opportunity. Their parks are shuttered. They might be losing a little bit of money. Maybe this is an opportunity. Let's look at the stock price. Yeah, it took a pretty big tumble in June. So, I don't know. Apple's market cap is a little bit higher.
Well,
$1.5 trillion. Remember, it was a big deal when they went to a trillion. They were like the first trillion-dollar company. They are now, thanks to a pretty big run-up through COVID, it's not hurt them. They've actually done pretty well. $1.47 trillion. It's a laughable number, isn't it? It's amazing.
And I remember when a million was big.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Austin Powers.
Who should
that.
I? Who should
How
I?
How about Jan in San Diego?
Jan in San Diego. Mac OS San Diego.
Well, we all know what Ron Burgundy says San Diego.
Yeah,
means,
no,
so
I,
we won't
yeah,
go there.
Yeah, you're right. Mac OS. I still like Mac OS Candido. I don't know. I like that one. Hey, Sandy Lee. I'm sorry, Jan Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Leo. I've got a couple problems with Apple Mail. I was hoping you can help me. Apple's still working on it. They've been trying for 2 weeks, and they can't come up with a solution.
I am so honored that you would, after Apple fails, come to me, humble little old me. What's the problem?
Well, two problems. First of all, on occasion, I'll get an email. It all looks fine. I even reply to it. Then I go and put it in one of my subfolders, and all of a sudden the message body disappears, even though it's still showing a size for the message, which means the content must be there somewhere. So I just can't see it.
So you see the two from the subject. You just can't. It's a blank window where the message body would be.
Right. And I'm looking at an email right now where this happened to it, and it's showing 64 kilobytes, which is...
Have you tried, there's a few things to try. Have you tried, and I'll have to look at Apple Mail. I don't use Apple Mail, but I used to. I've used it in the past. Have you tried viewing the source of the mail? I don't know if there's a way to do that in Apple Mail, where you actually are looking at, instead of the rendered version, that you're actually looking at the source of it. There must be.
I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I'm just looking here right now. To see if there's something like that in the menus. There is in a lot of email programs, but knowing Apple, they may hide that. If you can view the source, you can see, and it may well be, a lot of email is HTML. A lot of email, for instance, pulls its contents and images from the web. Really, a lot of mail is a web page these days. I don't like that. I think that's a security risk, so I tell my email client not to do that. The other thing you can do with Apple Mail is rebuild the index in Apple Mail, and that might help. But I don't know if that's this particular problem. So that's one. It probably is. Did they suggest doing that?
They're trying to avoid having me do anything drastic because I've got literally tens of thousands.
Yeah, they don't want you to lose anything. Well, hang on for a second. I have to take a break, but we can continue on through the commercial. But. You can right-click the email box and click rebuild, see if that helps. Sam, our car guy, coming up. My guess, though, is here's what I think is happening.
Okay.
And so you said there's two problems. So that was one. What's the other one?
The other one is they tried to restore the message from Time Machine. And Time Machine works for anything I can view that's in the Finder. But Apple Mail, there's no way to go in and click on any of the history, the historical instances, days, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Apple Mail only. It's fine for everything else, but not Apple Mail.
So is it just one message or is it a number of messages that do this?
This is very, very rare, but yeah. I'm looking at one right now.
Okay, so here's my theory.
Okay.
And there is a way to do this. So once you're in the message... that you're looking at right now, under the view menu, you could see message raw source. Most email programs will do this. And instead of trying to what Apple Mail does in most email programs, they take just like a web page. They take the text and the contents of the email and they try to draw it just like a web page would with images and fonts and all that stuff. If you view the source, you're viewing the raw text before rendering. Is there anything there?
Well, I'm in the view menu, and I don't see raw source as a choice.
Oh, I hope they didn't take that out. Let me see.
I've got the latest version of the Mac OS.
Yeah, it should be. It's also Command Option U. Yeah, it's under okay. View, Message, then if you open the Message menu, Show with Light Background, All Headers, Raw Source. That's what you want to look at. If you see...
I used your command, and I see the raw source.
Excellent. So you see text there.
A bunch of gibberish.
So that's what we call an HTML email. It's a web page. The problem probably is... Apple is blocking, or something, some security software, but most likely Apple is blocking that message from going out to the web and pulling in the resources it needs to display. That's a good thing.
Okay.
The reason I don't use Apple Mail, I don't use any email client that renders, that draws HTML mail. That's a security risk. If you look through that, you'll see it's probably trying to load images, is almost certainly trying to load JavaScript. And all of that stuff is from out there on the web. It's dangerous because it just like any web page could be dangerous. Is the email from someone you know?
Yes, my dentist.
Well, your dentist, assuming he actually sent this and it's not spoofed, your dentist probably is not sending something dangerous, but it may well be blocked. So you can see that there is a message there in the view source, but you can also... Go ahead.
I replied to it. It was there for a while, and I replied to it.
Yeah, I would guess that something's blocking that inbound traffic. When you view the source, it looks like gobbledygook, but you should see angle brackets and instructions. He's probably using MailChimp or some other mailing program that does HTML mail. And as a result, what you're getting is a web page. And for some reason, I'm disappointed Apple didn't figure this out. Apple or security. Do you run security software on your computer?
No, just whatever the computer has normally.
Yeah. Either Apple's blocking it or maybe the place the dentist hosted this is gone. Maybe he sent it via MailChimp and his account expired. So it could be linking to information that isn't on the web anymore. So there's a number of reasons. If you want to see what the message is, look through the gobbledygook for the text. Because that will be in there. I do not shave with a buck knife. And I don't use a straight edge razor on my delicate areas. No, I use this. I use the Lawnmower 3.0 from Manscaped. It's for a particular part of your body, although I guess you could use it anywhere. Manscaped is designed to groom gentlemen comfortably, safely, and you may be in quarantine, but there's no reason to give up your grooming, guys, especially if you're in quarantine with a significant other. I bet you that person would like. Now, this is a great Father's Day gift, by the way. If you have not yet gotten your Father's Day gift, I want you to go to manscaped.com and use the offer code Tech Guy. This is the newspaper that comes with the Manscaped. It's quite funny. It even includes serving suggestions, I guess you'd call those. It has all the instructions you need, but Micah explained to me what the newspaper is for. You put it on the ground to catch the hairs. Of course you do. What was I thinking as you manscaped? This, my friends, this. And by the way, somebody in the chat room saying your partner's supposed to do that. Absolutely, your partner. If you want, for fun, sure. Show your partner this. Great Father's Day gift, great gift for grads. It's never too early to learn about a good grooming. This is the Manscaped redesigned electric trimmer. This is the Lawnmower 3.0. They spent 18 months perfecting this trimmer. They just released the new one. I think this is remarkable. First of all, notice the small head. This is you could absolutely shave with that, or even shave your head if you want. But it's really designed for those tight hairpin turns, if you know what I mean. And they do it just right. This is the third generation. They've really figured things out. I'll take the guide comb off so you can see it. First of all, see those blades? Ceramic. That's the best. Super sharp. It's designed, it's cutting edge, literally, to prevent manscaping accidents. You do not want a nick, a cut. You do not. And if you're using a straight razor down there, please get this. Now, listen, this works at 7,000 RPMs. Can you hear it? Barely, right? It's very quiet, but also fast. Quiet stroke technology means much less likely to injure. Don't you love this? An LED light, so it illuminates where you're going for closer and more precise trimming. Battery loss lasts up to 90 minutes, but you can also, it's great, it's a USB charger. Here, I'll put it right here. So I keep this right by the sink, always ready for any important moments. It show off your mower loud and proud. It's a beautifully designed stand powered by USB. You could charge it right there. Now, the other thing I love is if you subscribe, they'll get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower every 3 months. I can't tell you how important that is. Now, everybody's got a different style. And, of course, this guide helps because you can set it long, short. It's up to you. You could take it off entirely for a close trim. This is a great gift. You won't have to leave the house. In fact, I've got the whole perfect package 3.0 plus peak hygiene plan here for the ungroomed guy in your life. You get this great shaving kit. You get the crop preserver and the crop reviver. And, of course, you get the lawnmower 3.0. A wonderful gift for birthdays, graduations. It's a lot of fun. I want you to experience this for yourself. Trim that junk of yours. Get 20% off plus free shipping at Manscaped, M-A-N-S-C-A-P-E-D, manscaped.com. Use the offer code TECHGUY. 20% off and free shipping. Manscaped.com. Use the offer code TECHGUY. This is not my personal lawnmower. I leave that at home. This is one for demonstration purposes only. They've got lots of other great stuff there, too. It is really a lot of fun. If it's time for dad or grad to get a gift, you see all the different products they've got. The crop mop, the crop cleanser, the foot duster, their fine cologne. And yes, if you want to use a straight razor, they even sell the plow. It's actually a really nice, got a brass handle, zinc alloy head, really nice shaver. Manscaped, make manscaping a habit and help the guy in your life just be a little tidier. 20% off, free shipping, go to manscaped.com. Past tense, because you are Manscaped now, manscaped.com. Use the offer code TECHGUY, and this is I love this perfect package. It is a really nice. Comes in a plain brown box. It's really wonderful. Manscaped.com. Don't forget the offer code TECHGUY. It's time to talk automotive with Sam Abul Samad. He's our car guy, principal researcher at Guidehouse Insights. He's also a podcaster. His Wheel Bearings podcast is a must listen if you love cars. Wheelbearings.media. Just real quickly before we talk to Sam, I just want to mention what I talked to Jan a little bit more. There is a way in Apple Mail and almost all email programs to look at not the rendered email, the email that's drawn with pictures and fonts and stuff, but the actual source code that the email program is using to render. You can see it in Apple Mail under the View menu. There's a message menu, and in that there's a raw source selection. When you select that, if you see text, you got the email. It's just for some reason Apple Mail is declining to render it. Either those resources it's trying to pull in from the web aren't there, or security policies are blocking it. As I mentioned to Jan, you can go through the plain text of the email and try to figure out, ignoring the stuff that's just gobbledygook, which usually is JPEGs and things like that, and look for text. And you can read what the email says in the plain text. A lot of newsletters come that way. I really don't like it. In fact, I think it's a security hazard. I don't use any email program that renders HTML, renders web pages in email. That's a big security risk. I use MailMate on the Macintosh, which is pure text. And it's not very pretty, but that's the way the email should be. Hello, Sam. Sorry to take a little chunk out of your segment there. Good to see you.
Hello, Leo. How are you today?
I'm good. How are things in Ypsilanti?
Beautiful day today. It's about mid-70s and sunny outside.
I'm so jealous. You're coming in off your computer microphone. If you can switch that over to your fancy Heil PR40, we'd be able to hear the rich, dulcet tones of Sam Abu Samad.
Was done that the Heil earlier.
That's all right. I can still understand you. It just sounds like you're on a phone, which most people are. So that's not the end of the world. It is a radio show after all.
Yeah.
Sam's sitting in front of a electric vehicle.
Oh, here we go. It's actually a partially electric vehicle. It is a plug-in hybrid. It's the Ford Escape plug-in hybrid.
Oh.
Sound any better?
Much better. So a plug-in hybrid. Hmm.
So, yeah, plug it. The reason I brought this one up today is because I got an email earlier this week from a listener of the Tech Guy podcast, but it was an email to the Wheel Bearings feedback email asking a question. Sam Monteith has started listening to the Wheel Bearings podcast, and he's looking for a car to replace one of their existing vehicles and was thinking about a plug-in hybrid. And so it just so happens that earlier this week or last Monday, Ford announced the fuel the range numbers and the fuel economy estimates for the new Escape plug-in hybrid. So this is the third variant of the Escape, the new Escape that's coming out. And it's one of several plug-in hybrids in this compact crossover class that are coming to market this year. This segment, the compact crossovers, is one of the most popular segments in the market.
I love how the audio industry has these names for their compact crossover. Okay, I got it.
Yeah, so this is a smaller sized crossover utility.
Crossover means it's half car, half SUV.
Yeah, it's based on a car platform, but it looks kind of like an SUV, hence crossover.
It's the most popular category, isn't it?
It's after pickup trucks, after full-size pickup trucks, yeah.
Pickup trucks are number one? Category.
Yeah.
Really?
Ford F-150 or the Ford F-Series sells about 850,000 units a year in the U.S., so they're way out in front, and they're followed by GM and Ram.
I have to say,
selling trucks.
I'm very glad I saw that Ford plans an electric F-150. I love electric vehicles in 2022, so that's exciting. But so this is a plug-in hybrid. That's a little different than an electric vehicle.
Right. So this, it has both electric drive and it has an internal combustion engine. So, we've had hybrids now. In fact, this year is the 20th anniversary of the Toyota Prius in the U.S. market.
20 years. Dang.
Yeah. Came to the U.S. in 2000, launched in Japan in 97, came to the U.S. in 2000. So you have a mix. It can drive on either electric only or on the gas engine, or a blend of both, so that you get some regenerative braking that's stored in a battery, and then it can use that to boost a smaller internal combustion engine, and gets great fuel economy. But some people, if you wanted to drive on electric only, the battery is so small you can only go about a mile or so typically on a typical hybrid with electricity alone. A plug-in hybrid gives you a larger battery. In this case, it's a 14.4 kilowatt hour battery. Typical hybrid is a 1.5 kilowatt hour battery. So it's about 10 times the size of a typical hybrid battery. And you get a plug, so you can plug it in. And in the case of the new Escape, you can go about 37 miles on a charge. And one of the first plug-in hybrids was the original Chevrolet Volt, which came out also 10 years ago now in 2010. And when that first Volt came out, it had a range of 35 miles on a charge, and then the engine would start up and run the generator to keep the battery charged. This Escape can go 37 miles, And it's a much more practical vehicle than that Volt was. The Volt was kind of small and cramped inside. It only had space for four passengers because of the big battery that ran down the center tunnel. The Escape, the battery is packaged underneath the back seat. So it doesn't, unlike the last plug-in hybrid from Ford, the C-Max, it doesn't take up all the cargo space. So you still have all your cargo space. It goes 37 miles on a charge. Gets equivalent of what they call 100 miles per gallon equivalent. And then also coming later this summer, we have the Toyota RAV4 Prime, which is their plug-in hybrid version, which is projected to get 42 miles on a charge. So, you know, it's the nice thing about these is depending on where you live, what your lifestyle is, you know, 37 to 40 miles on a charge, most people, you know, 90% of people can do all of their daily commuting without using any gas. They can just plug it in at night. You can do all your running around during the day, drive to work, to school, whatever. Never use any gas. And then when you want to take a road trip, you still have that engine there. You just go.
So it eliminates the need to worry about range anxiety. And it handles 90% of the driving most people do. It just, you know, you just go to and from work or the grocery store. I think that's a good, a clever idea. But, you know, the other thing I worry about with things like the Prius and hybrids is that the engines don't have much oomph. In this Escape, is it using the engine to drive the wheels or generate electricity?
It's using, in hybrid mode, it's using the engine to drive the wheels along with the electric motor. So
doing
that,
both.
You know, I haven't driven the plug-in hybrid yet, but I've driven the regular hybrid Escape and also the RAV4 hybrid, which is also available. And these newer hybrids have a lot more total power. So unlike, you know, some of the early Priuses that were definitely kind of slow, you know, these actually have pretty decent performance. So you've got plenty of oomph, all the oomph that most people normally need.
That's good. Yeah, because I remember driving the Prius in the old days, and it was kind of a little bit sluggish.
Yeah. You know? Well, and the nice thing about these two, you know, the Ford and Toyota plug-in hybrids is Ford and Toyota still haven't hit the 200,000 sales mark for their plug-in vehicles.
Oh, so you get the
You can still get a tax credit, federal tax credit on those.
Nice.
So the Escape is going to start at just over $33,000. The tax credit, I think, is about $6,400. So you can get one of these for about $27,000.
Are these more popular than all electric, full electric?
They're not. Battery electrics are selling a little better than plug-in hybrids.
Interesting. But they don't suit for everybody. There are a lot of people who can't.
Yeah, it's not the right solution for everybody. But for a certain segment of the market, you know, if you want something that can do most of your driving electrically and still not have to deal with range anxiety for road trips, it's a great solution.
Is it out now, the Ford Escape plug-in hybrid?
It'll be in dealers in the next few weeks.
Good.
And then the Prius, or the RAV4 later in the summer.
Sam Abul Samad, he's our car guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, and you save batteries, you save weight. It's faster to charge.
Yeah, I mean, you've got more weight than you do. You've got more weight than you do with a regular hybrid. You know, so I mean, the regular hybrids will do about 40 miles per gallon on their own.
Right.
And if you know, so you're dragging along more weight. It is more costly. Although right now, while you have the tax credit, it's actually cheaper to buy the plug-in than the regular hybrid because there's no tax credit on the regular hybrid.
Right.
But that's,
I think about
that's
people like my daughter who rents. She doesn't have a charger and she's a renter, right. So she's not going to. You know, she can't really do an all-electric vehicle. And I imagine there are a lot of people in apartments and other places that just can't do all-electric. So this is a good intermediate.
You know, and if you have somewhere to plug in at work, for example, if you have workplace charging and you can plug in at work, then, you know, you can plug it in there and you can do almost all your driving electrically.
You can do 110-volt charging too, right? You don't have to. See, it takes a while, but I bet overnight it would charge.
Yeah, I mean during an 8-hour workday, you pretty much top it up depending on how far you're driving.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but if you don't have workplace charging available to you then and you can't charge at home, then I definitely wouldn't recommend getting the plug-in hybrid.
Right.
Because then you're carrying around a lot more weight.
Unnecessarily.
You know, you're better off with just the regular hybrid in that case.
Yeah.
Cool,
Sam. Always a pleasure. What is this charger with the crescent moon? Whose is that?
I don't know. I think that that's just a render
just
that Ford's. They did. Yeah.
Imaginary.
It's a press photo for this thing. And generally when they do these photos, they shoot them in the studio.
Right.
A white background and Photoshop in everything else. Yeah.
They don't want to plug anybody's particular charger. I see Electrify America, those rolling out pretty good. I think they said they have 1,000 stations now in California. So that's good. I'll be just in time for my Mach-E.
You bet.
All right, Sam. Have a great one.
You too,
Leo. See you next week. Stay safe.
Bye-bye.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo if you want to talk high tech. Well, I stirred up a hornet's nest here with our last caller, Jan. I said, and I shocked, I guess, the chat room, I don't use and don't recommend using HTML email programs. Don't render HTML. The problem, of course, first of all, we know that most phishing attacks, most malware comes in through email. And most of the time, it is done in an attempt to get you to run a program, which would be an attachment generally. That's why I don't like email attachments either. And the attachment might look like, just a pure data file, a text file or PDF, but it is in fact a program. And you open it, you double click it saying, okay, I want to open this spreadsheet the boss just sent me because he needs me to do some work. And it turns out it's not a spreadsheet. It's malware. Maybe it's ransomware and infects your whole machine. So this is kind of the typical way people get infected. HTML helps. These beautiful, pretty emails. I was reading the other day about the IncrediMail. Remember that? IncrediMail? That you could subscribe, and IncrediMail was a program that would make your emails just dance. They'd be dancing bears. There'd be images there. It shut down in March, thank goodness. Hallelujah. But for 20 years, people were sending these fancy emails. What they didn't understand was these emails really were just web pages. And the way most email programs work, Outlook, Apple's Mail, almost all email programs work, if you just preview the email, you're just scrolling through the email and you see that page, it is loading in all that content, much of it from the outside world, just as if you were on a web page. The difference is on a web page, you're going to that page explicitly, so you presume some trust. You're not just kind of randomly loading stuff. Email, there's a lot of spam junk mail. 91% of all phishing scams come through email, so there's a lot of junk in there. So as you go through your mailbox and as your email program is drawing it on the screen, it's pulling down information from untrusted websites. It's essentially just going to random websites. Worse than random. These are websites sent to you, often with the aim of hacking you. There's a lot of tricks HTML can play. For instance, it can look exactly like your bank's email. And the link, they put it in broad letters. Log in here to update your account. Even looks like it's got the name of your bank. You can see it. There it is. It's got to be real. You click on it. It's not. Because the HTML, the web page, the pictures, the fancy text, the dancing bears are hiding what's underneath, which is a link to hacker.com. They can also have payloads. They can be JavaScript and other programs. Your email program, just like your browser, is designed to load content from untrusted sources on the net and play it back. PDFs, fonts, all of them can be malware. All of them can be dangerous. Every time you use HTML emails, every time you're scrolling through those, you don't even have to open them. You're just looking at them one by one. You're running programs from untrusted sources out there in the world. It's a problem. And then people in the chat room are saying, oh, but I can't, all my emails, I wouldn't be able to read emails. No. Stop the insanity. I've given up, but I don't do it, and I wouldn't recommend you do it. And you can, in many cases, you can tell your email program, do not render HTML, do not draw these emails. There's a kind of an intermediate rich text format, which gives you a lot of the pretty features of HTML without many of the risks. So you could use that if you really want to, but I just, to me, it's plain text. Can't hurt you. It can't hurt you. Don't open attachments. It's not going to look as pretty. It's not going to have fonts and tables and images and big buttons that say click here to update your account. It's not going to have any of that stuff. In fact, it's probably, unfortunately, these days, going to have a lot of gobbledygook. That's what I told Jan to do. View source, because now you're not looking at the HTML. For some reason, that web page isn't rendering. So if you view the source, it was an email from his dentist. And the dentist is using something like IncrediMail. You know, it's probably called Incredental Mail. And it's, you know, because he has a dancing tooth and a toothbrush going, oh, how fun. And for whatever reason, it's not being, I use the term rendered. I hope that's not too obscure. Drawn. It's not being drawn by the email program. The email program, Apple Mail, is just given a white screen. So there's a number of reasons it might not draw it. It could be the mail is corrupt or malformed. And so those instructions aren't working. He was able to see the text, the actual source, as we call it, the underlying text. That's good. If you view source and you can see it, well, you've got a message there. And then you can kind of look through it, ignoring the gobbledygook. You know, I get emails all the time, you know, that have things in them like H32497JJ1172.jpg. It's an image. It's an image, but it doesn't have a reasonable name. It has a numeric, you know, random name. A lot of, if you get newsletters, MailChimp, and a lot of, almost all newsletters work this way. They're sending you a web page. That's not safe. It's not safe. It's not safe. I don't know how many times I can say that. Yes, it's pretty, and you got dancing teeth. But if you view the source, you should be able, the right way to do this, by the way, is for the email itself to say, if you can't view this, click this link to go to my webpage. You'd be able to view it there. That should be very visible right at the top. Even better, there should be, and you can easily do this. Well, they don't, but you could easily do it. Have a text version of the email so that when I get the email and it sees, oh, your email program doesn't draw the beautiful dancing teeth, well, you give me the text, so I get the content of the email minus the teeth. I prefer that. Unfortunately, people stop doing that in some cases, so you just get nothing. In his case, it could be the mail is damaged. More likely, the source of the JavaScript program, the JPEGs, the fonts, all of those loaded from out there on the web, those sources are down or out, or maybe the dentist didn't pay his fees, so it can't draw it. But if you view the source, you should be able to see what it's trying to say. And I hope somewhere in there, there's some text saying it's time for your appointment. Click this link to schedule it. That's not safe in HTML email, but in the plain text, the source for it, the underlying code, it should have a real web link that at least you can read what it is and know where you're going. And if it's not your dentist's website, don't go there. It's because, you know, it's a battle between people who want the email to look as good as a web page. If you're looking at your email and it looks like a web page, you're getting HTML email, and that is a security risk. And it's, by the way, also spying on you. So very frequently, certainly email lists, newsletter lists like MailChimp do this, almost certainly they've got what they call a one-pixel image, an image you can't see. It's just a white dot. But it is loaded from their servers. So they know if you've opened that email, if you're reading it, and they know exactly when. That, to me, is also a privacy violation. They've set up the email in such a way that it pings their servers when I'm reading it. None of their business whether I read their junk mail or not, in my humble opinion. Anyway, there's the reasons I don't like it. My suggestion is not to use it. Obviously, most people are going to because most people want to see the dancing toothbrush and the little happy smiley teeth. Bing! If you see that, then you know. Well, hey, hey, hey! How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We got your smartphones. We got your smartwatches. We got all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO, the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Latest rumor on Google. You know that Google skipped their developers conference last month, Google I.O. That's normally when they would announce a second generation Pixel phone. These are the Google Android phones that are pure Google. I think they're really good. It's what I carry. This is the Pixel 4. They were supposed to announce the Pixel 4a, the half-priced smaller brother. It's not smaller, but little brother, less expensive brother to the Pixel 4. The 3a was very successful. And usually I tell people who say, oh, I like those Pixel phones. I say, wait for the A version because you're going to save money and it's going to be 99% as good. Doesn't have as many camera lenses usually, things like that. Rumor mill, John Prosser, who's very good at this, has been quite accurate in the past, both with Apple and Google, initially said next month, July, Google was going to announce it. Now, he just said on the Twitter, it's been delayed again to October. Now, I have to think that that's due to manufacturing issues due to COVID-19. I don't know. October is when, you know, that's roughly when you get the new iPhone. I don't know. Maybe Google's thinking if we release it around that time, you know, people are talking about a $1,200 iPhone 12. We could say, or you can get our $400 Pixel 4a. I don't know. And again, it's just a rumor. But just, I thought I'd pass it along in case you've been waiting for the 4a. Because we really did think it was going to come out any day now. Maybe not. Back to the phones. Alan in North Hollywood. Hello, Alan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hello.
Actually, I'm happy because my call, I've called you before, but usually they're not relevant to what you've been talking about, but this is.
Oh, good.
I'm looking for an application for our computer club that we can use like Zoom software conferencing because we can't have any computer club meetings.
Yeah.
It's a small club, under 10 people, but the requirements are that it be secure and that it be free.
So I am less and less a fan of Zoom. You know, I was really not a fan last year. Zoom did some, I think, bad things. For instance, their installer on the Macintosh, even when you uninstalled it, stayed on the system and basically opened a web server on your Mac that allowed bad guys to get into your computer. When told about this, Zoom said, never mind. They finally, Apple had to fix it for them. So Zoom was already in, you know, kind of not in the on my good list. Then they said, "Oh yes, security." You know, there were a lot of security issues. We're gonna concentrate on that. We're not gonna add any new features because suddenly everybody's using Zoom. Their Zoom stock's through the roof. They've more than quadrupled their usage over the last few months because everybody uses Zoom. But they continue to do annoying things. So they hired a bunch of security experts. But they didn't hire them to fix Zoom. They hired them to write a paper about how Zoom should be fixed and then step away. So it remains to be seen whether Zoom will actually be fixed. And I have some doubts that last week Zoom's CEO talked a little bit about how, well, we aren't going to make encryption. We're not going to put encryption on our free product because we want law enforcement to be able to see the free stuff. But then they talked about how they're going to do it in the paid product and in effect revealed that they have the keys and they could still give it to law enforcement. And then just this past Friday, we found out that Zoom revoked the account of an American activist because he was doing a Zoom conference on the anniversary of Tiananmen Square. Chinese government didn't like it. And as a result, Zoom, which is, by the way, not a Chinese company, it's run in the United States, but all the programmers are in China. Zoom yanked this American's account. They apologized, said, oh, we'll never do that again, gave it back. They keep apologizing. They keep doing it. You're right not to use Zoom. I wish I could get people to stop using Zoom. I don't believe them when they say we're going to be secure. I really don't. They've paid lip service. They've spent a lot of money, but I don't believe that they're going to do it. So Yes, there's a great answer. There's an open source program. There's a number of ways to do this. The one I would recommend, completely free, very Zoom-like. It's actually easier than Zoom because you don't have to install anything. It's called Jitsi. Jitsi, jitsi.org. It uses a technology Google invented called WebRTC, but it's an open source technology that means you can do a conference in a browser with no additional software. It works best in Chrome, but I use it in Firefox. It works fine. So it's open source. It's completely free. You can use their server, but for real security, I have my own Jitsi server. If you have a server lying around, or you can use DigitalOcean or one of the online virtual private servers, personal servers, I actually just set up my own little server and put it on there. It was very easy to do. I'm running Debian. It has a Linux install. It's simple. You have certificates. And the encryption works between parties. And because it's only going through you, you have complete control over it. So it's completely private, completely secure, no Chinese government observations, and it's completely free. I don't know why Jitsi didn't take off, to be honest with you, but JITSI.org. And it's also really good for a computer, I think, for a computer club to use because it's not a commercial product. And you know, you guys are geeks. What's the name of the computer club?
VTUG.
What do you talk about?
Well, we started out as a TRS-80 user
awesome.
Group.
Awesome.
So, as you can see, we've been around for a while. In the San Fernando Valley, TRS-80 Users Group.
Is I love it.
What it started out as, and then we diluted it to Technology Users Group because obviously we're not much into TRS-80s anymore. And we've been around for so long, a long time.
Well, like most user groups now, there's a certain graying going on, isn't there?
Oh, yes. Yes.
But, you know, the kids today, they don't understand. It's good. We gray hairs, we are the keepers of the flame here, let me tell you. And we still want to know how this stuff works. So is it vtug.com.org? Where can people go if they're in the valley?
Well,
do you have a website?
We haven't. We're not on the internet.
That's how old this club is.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it that it started with the TRS-80, and it's still going strong. I think you would. You don't need to set up a server because Jitsi will let you use their server for free. I think it works quite well. It might not work as well as Zoom does with conferences of hundreds of people, but you don't have to worry about that. It works just fine with 10 people, no problem.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds exactly like what we needed. And,
good.
You know, how do you look something like that up otherwise?
Right.
So
that's why you call me. That's what I'm here for. You know, this is a user group, really. This is just like a VTUG. It's a users group.
It is.
Yeah. It's just on the radio. And we help each other out. We, you know, we stand up, ask questions. I love users groups. Grew up, cut my teeth on users groups. Because in the early days of technology, you know, what did you get with a TRS-80? You got a baggie with a mimeographed, wasn't even Xerox, a mimeographed pamphlet about how to use it. We had to help each other. And that's why I love users groups. We're still doing it. Well, it's great to talk to you. And thank you for letting me get on my high horse about Zoom. I'm not happy with what Zoom's up to.
That's why we didn't adopt it, because we heard about all that. So.
Now, Jitsi runs just fine on anything you can run a browser on. If you want to use it on a mobile device, and it does work fine on iOS and Android, they have a free program you can download. But otherwise, it's exactly the same.
Excellent.
I think it's a perfect choice for any computer group,
Sure. Well, thank you very much for that.
My pleasure. I'm glad you called. Glad I could give a plug to Jitsi. I'm a believer. And I wish, you know, the good news is Zoom isn't the only company offering, you know, all the facilities that Zoom offers. I mean, it does a lot more than Jitsi does, including the phone bridge and the ability to record and ability to have thousands of people in a conference. So if you need all that, I guess Zoom Although you have to look at, I mean, Google's offering meet for free now, Microsoft Teams for free. Everybody wants to get on this act. Everybody's looking at Zoom saying, how come them? What? Why ever? And I think really it was ease of use. Everything Zoom did that, in my opinion, was dumb and insecure helped make it easier to use. And it paid off, right? Because, well, they just proved nobody really cares about security. They just make it easy to use and pretty, and I'll be happy. That's why I'm like Don Quixote, chasing at windmills, trying to get you to use plain text email and open source software like Jitsi. Our show today brought to you by LinkedIn Learning. I've talked about LinkedIn Learning many times on Twit. I'm a huge fan of LinkedIn Learning. I think you know that. Many of my friends work for LinkedIn Learning, have designed courses in photography and Photoshop. That's what I like about LinkedIn Learning. The absolute experts in any particular field teaching what they know and doing it in a format that is so much better than just some random YouTube video. Beautifully shot, organized, with additional materials like practice projects, quizzes. So you're really learning. You're really learning. You know, if you are in, you know, a profession, you probably know. There are very few professions that don't change, you know. You probably know there's always new skills that would be useful. Always new horizons. I told you, I'm a lifelong learner. I think a lot of you are. I think that's one way to keep excited and engaged in what you do at work. And I think LinkedIn Learning is your partner in that. It's where you can get skills that are timely, like how to master working from home, that are aspirational, like the foundations of entrepreneurship. If you want to start a business, boy, that's a great place to go. If you're a boss, how to be a resilient leader. They have a course I really want to take this called Grit. How teams persevere to accomplish great goals. Courses in every area, not just geeky skills, but leadership skills, networking strategies, productivity tips, how to find a productive mindset. LinkedIn Learning has more than 16,000 courses. 16,000 courses. Each course has multiple videos in nice small chunks so you can absorb them at your leisure on your computer, on your phone, whenever you've got a free moment. And you'll learn great skills that will help you right now get through these tough times, but also help you in the future. Plus, if you go to LinkedInLearning.com/tech guy, LinkedInLearning.com/tech guy, you'll receive a custom tailored course recommendations to help you develop yourself along the right lines. And once you've completed a course, you get a great certificate. You can put it on your LinkedIn profile. I find that very helpful as you look for work or you try to network. Having that certificate there tells people, I know my stuff. I know this stuff. LinkedIn Learning is where you can grow your skills, grow your career, grow your brain cells. Learn from the best expert instructors and connect with a global network of experience. Keep learning those skills so you can rise to the occasion, this occasion or any moment in the future. 1 month free for you right now. Good deal. Go to LinkedInLearning.com/tech guy. LinkedInLearning.com/tech guy. Like I said, I think it keeps you young to keep learning new skills. It keeps the mind flexible, keeps it vibrant. It makes you a better boss. It makes you a better employee. And this is the place to go for great courses. LinkedInLearning.com/tech guy. We thank them so much for supporting our podcast. I hope you're learning something here. And I hope you'll support our podcast by going to LinkedInLearning.com/tech guy. And enjoy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Musical director, Lady Laura, doing a fabulous job today. Let's get back. By the way, Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, is joining us in just a few minutes to talk about, we're going to have a photo review, assignment review. So that's good. Talk about our pictures illustrating the new normal, whatever that might be for you. Fred in Columbia, Maryland. Hello, Fred.
How are you today?
I'm wonderful, Fred. How are you?
You remember me? I'm the gentleman that's a Korean War veteran, talked the low vision devices.
I remember you. Yeah, get closer to the phone if you can.
Bluetooth going through my hearing aids.
Oh, that's good. So you hear me, but the problem is you hear me fine, but the phone is way over. No, I want to hear you better, but I hear you great now. Thank you, Fred.
Okay. My question is, a lady friend of mine in our group is not computer literate.
Yeah.
So she has a 19-inch monitor, but it does not have a camera. So I suggested she buy a webcam.
You
so
bet.
She got a Logitech C270.
Very nice.
Does not how to make it work.
Well.
Can you explain to her on your page how it can be set up that she can access it?
I'm pleased that she was able to get it. Because a lot of these cameras, I guess by now, everybody who wanted one has got one, so they're easing up a little bit. I do see, though, on the Logitech page, it's limit 2 per household.
She got it from Logitech.
Yeah.
They mailed it to us.
Yeah.
Mars.
So we'll put it on the page, but I'll tell you also, Fred. But first, I want to ask you, did you ever get your pictures scanned and up on the internet? We want to see your pictures.
Oh, okay. No, I haven't. I've been rather sick.
I'm sorry.
I turn 90 next week.
You need to find some kid. You know, these days, kids don't come around saying, can I mow your lawn, mister, for a buck? They say, can I come over and scan your photos see if you can find some tame teenager to come over and, because we want to see him.
I actually have a caregiver who's very good with my computer.
Perfect.
My iPad Pro and my iPhone.
Perfect.
So she'll be able to scan them for me. I bought the Epson scanner, by the way.
Oh, good. Yeah, because we don't want to lose these pictures. I mean, historic as much as memories, you know?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Yep.
So to very simply, this Logitech camera, which is, by the way, only $40 from Logitech. That's a great price. It's not the fanciest camera they make, but for most people, it's fine. It's a 720p camera. That means it's high def. And it goes right on top of the screen. It's got a little flexible hinge that makes it possible to put it on the screen. And then it'll have a cable coming off of it that you plug into the computer. That's a USB cable.
Yes, it is. She's done that, but she doesn't know what to do after she plugs it in. They give her no instructions.
Yeah, because there's really not a lot to do. At this point, she's going to just launch her software, and it should see the camera. What does she use to make these video calls? Do you know?
Yeah, she uses Zoom.
So when she launches Zoom, you Zoom should ask you right when it launches, hey, I need to use your camera, give me permission. But if she already did that, yeah, and didn't pay attention, there are also settings within Zoom to choose the video input. And anything plugged in like that will show up as a camera in Zoom. So she just has to select the Logitech. You know, it'll probably say, I'm not sure, but something like Logitech C270. She selects that from the menu. She should also, at that time, be able to see herself. There'll be an image of her. She can also select the microphone input at that point. So you get the audio and you get the video, and now she can make a Zoom call. And I have to say, I am completely sympathetic. I know this is hard. This is one of the reasons Zoom has succeeded where other programs haven't, because it's of them all, it's the easiest, but it doesn't mean it's easy. It's easiest. It's still a little confusing. The camera has no software, doesn't require anything installed, because Windows and Mac, all computers, even Linux computers, see that as a webcam input. And so you plug it in, and then the software that's designed to use webcams, Zoom is one of them, should pull it up and make it available. So he's got it. Now, off the top of my head, I can't remember what the Zoom settings look like. I'm thinking there might be either in the menu or there's three dots or something like that in the lower right-hand corner. I don't use Zoom, as I've mentioned. I'm actually compelled to use Zoom fairly frequently because we use it at work. Nobody, everybody knows Zoom. Everybody wants Zoom. Let me see if I have it. I probably have it on this computer here. Let me launch it. Yep, of course I do. The other thing I don't like about Zoom is that I have to install software. I really don't want to install any software. Is anybody in the chat room sitting in front of Zoom? Where is that button? Where is the button that you pushed? Somewhere there's the settings. It's probably at least in the menu. Go to the preferences, and you're looking for audio and video preferences. Thank you, Joey. Joey says, you know that picture, the icon that's your account? Click that. It's under that top right corner. Your icon's up there. That's right. And then Chumley in the chat room says, they keep moving the button around. That's modern technology, isn't it? It's so funny that people use Zoom because it's easy to use, except it's not. It's just easier than all the rest, really. It's still crazy confusing. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, he's visiting his folks. Isn't that nice? He'll join us from Mom's house and talk about our photos next. Chris Marquardt is here. Well, actually, he's at his folks' house. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, I've done a family visit. After not having seen my parents in months, I'm finally seeing them again.
That's nice. It's nice. Yeah. I miss my mom. Nice. We FaceTime a lot, but
It's not quite the same, is it?
Isn't it? It's not, yeah. I want to give him a hug. And Father's Day is coming up. My son says, can I come over? And I said, no. We'll have to figure it out. We have a photo assignment, and actually it's very appropriate because the assignment was the word normal. This is the new normal.
It's wonderful. So, of course, people have a new normal now, and the photo assignment clearly showed that. So I've taken some of the examples that have to do with quarantine, and that is the review for today. And we have some really awesome shots in there, and I've picked three. And the first one I picked is by Doug Berba. Title is Normal Spacing.
Oh, I love this.
What Doug did is he shot down at his feet, and he pictured the signs that you see on the ground that try to help you keep the distance in stores and outside of stores.
Yeah.
Little arrows and logos of feet and things. So, yeah, there's a lot of those on the ground right now.
Really nice. That is fun.
And the way he did it is he made it a triptych. He put three pictures in one. There's like several apps out there that you can do it, or if you're good with Photoshop or Affinity Photo or something, that's easy to do. And in this case, it really works well because those three things go together and they're still kind of different. The left one, he's pointing to the side. The right two ones, he's pointing straight on. But then on the third one, on the rightmost one, he's kind of
faced the wrong way.
So there's little Easter eggs in there, little things to discover.
That makes it so much more interesting. You know, he could have had the first photo be oriented the same as the other two, but he chose not to. He rotated it so that the feet are pointed. And I think that's really cool. And then, yes, that third one is, there's a little story to tell there that you don't see immediately. And then you go, the feet are the wrong way. I like it. Very clever. Yeah.
Maybe a very deep cry for help to get out of
it. Help me.
The other way. Maybe that's what it is.
I love it.
Second one I chose is by Gregory Chesney, titled Speed Masking. And this is a picture that is pure emotion for me. It's blurry. It's black and white. It is blurry, motion blur. So the camera's been moving. It shows two figures, two people, and you can clearly see with all the blur in there that they're wearing masks. And one is raising his hand, maybe to hail a taxi, or maybe to just hold himself up there.
Now, this is interesting because it's not what you would call technically an impressive, you know, a technically perfect photo. It's blurry. It's very contrasty. So
there's a good chance most people would not
pick it.
That.
Say, oh, I blew it. My camera was moving. Yeah.
And in this one, no, I think really the emotion comes from everything that is not technical in the photo. So, yeah, that's a good reason why maybe you shouldn't dump all the photos. Maybe you should keep some, even if they are blurry or out of focus.
One of the great photographers of the 20th century, Henri Cartier-Bresson, has many pictures that he took that are blurry like that. They're black and white, and people are moving, and they're blurry, and they're considered classics. Among the greatest photos of all time. And I always try to remind myself of that when I see a picture like this.
Here's a good exercise. Go on Google and search for the most iconic photos and find a list of iconic photos. And there's a very good chance that a lot of them will be technically not interesting, not sharp, not in focus, and weirdly composed, but still, there's something about these photos that cannot be explained by...
It's emotion. I think emotion's a really good way to describe it. Yeah.
And the third one I picked is by Gerald Wiley. And I think this is, like, made me laugh out loud. So what he does in his photo is, it's a black and white shot. We see a door from the outside. And it's a screen door. And the first thing that jumped at me was the cat at the top. So in the top part of the window, you see a cat, and that's climbing up that screen. So it clearly wants out. And then my eyes went further down, and I saw a second cat looking through the window, being stuck inside, quarantined. And then Gerald did a self-portrait, and he put himself in there as well. So he's down there with the cats and has a mask on and kind of has a longing look towards the camera, like, when can I get out? So that's a funny photo.
They're literally climbing the walls.
It is a funny, I think it speaks for many people. I think many people feel what he put in this photo.
Yeah. Trapped. I love it. These were three really interesting ways to look at the new normal. I think you picked some really good winners. Now, we'll put links. I know you're listening. You can't see them, but you can imagine from what's Chris's description. And, of course, we'll put links to them on our website at techguylabs.com. And all of it's on Flickr. We have a great Flickr group. I highly recommend it. It's a great – I was just saying to Chris, it's a bunch of really fun, interesting, talented photographers and people like me who aren't necessarily all that talented, but who really enjoy photography. And I highly recommend it. You can join it and participate in our next assignment. What is that, by the way?
Well, the next assignment has, again, been supplied by the community, by Demilente, and it's outside. So now that we have a lot of inside photos, a lot of quarantine-related photos, now we can go outside again, at least in most places. And outside is the topic for the next assignment.
Outside. Now, here's how this works. You have to go outside. Actually, no, I shouldn't even say that. You could be inside looking out, right? You get to interpret what it means outside, just the word or the concept. You can take – the idea really is not a contest. It's just take pictures. It's to encourage you to use your eye and take pictures. It doesn't have to be a fancy camera. It could be your camera phone, whatever you've got. Take a picture that illustrates the word or concept outside. Upload it to Flickr. That's a free photo sharing site. We love it. Flickr.com. And tag it with the tag TG Outside, if you would. That way we'll know that this is your submission for TG Outside. Then submit it to the Tech Guy group. Renee Silverman will look at the tag TG Outside. And she'll put it in that pool. Chris will review it in 4 weeks thereabouts. We'll pick a couple of photos from the pool, and Chris will talk about them, and that will be your reward, your notoriety. But also the reward is, getting out there and taking photos outside. That should be fun. You'll find Chris at photosensei.net. This is his new site where he is now that we're all quarantined.
I just realized the URL is not the right one. Sensei.photo.
Oh, I got it backwards.
Yes.
So it's sensei.photo. Okay.
Sensei.photo.
All right. Forget I said anything. Sensei.photo. That's where he's teaching people using Zoom? No, using something better than Zoom to get better photography, better photographs, one-on-one. You can get coaching and assignment reviews and all that. Sensei.photo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Back to the phones we go, line 4. Thanks for hanging on. Craig in Albuquerque. Hello, Craig.
Well, howdy, Leo.
Howdy.
Now, my question is regarding Linux.
Okay.
We use Linux at home, and we've been on CentOS 5.11 for like 10 years.
Yeah.
And my wife, who is not computer literate, has enough trouble with remembering what to do if I updated the system so I could use a modern browser, which is actually our only thing I'd need to update.
CentOS, C-E-N-T-O-S, which is derived from Red Hat's enterprise version, is actually super stable. A lot of people use it for servers for that reason. However, CentOS 5.0 is, you know, pretty old. They're up to eight. Yeah. The real question is the underlying Linux she doesn't know about. It's the desktop environment that she's aware about. Which environment are you using?
We're running GNOME 2, and the only choices we have for that would be GNOME 3, which I despise.
No, don't use GNOME 3, you're not alone in despising GNOME 3. And so that's why there is still a desktop environment based on GNOME 2 that you can use.
I've heard of Mate, but that has different icons and things.
Yeah, the icons might change because people update the icons to have higher quality, you know, higher quality resolution and all that. The one that I think I would try is XFCE. It was designed to be GNOME, you know, GNOME 2, basically. So you get all the GNOME apps that you're used to. You'll have most of the same operating, and you can probably customize, you know, XFCE is very customizable, so you can probably customize it so that the menus, the panels, all of that are the same that she's used to.
Okay.
It might take a little effort on your part and maybe a little effort on her part to get used to it, but yeah, you do want to update it. There's security updates. It works better. It's probably faster, and you hit the biggest one, which is modern software will work on a newer version. It might not work on an older version.
Yeah, we can't do Zoom on Linux. I've had to do that on.
Yeah. Windows. Zoom does have, as you know, a web interface, which will work just fine on Linux, but you need a modern browser.
And
if you can't run a modern browser, you can't run Zoom. So, yeah, people, you were not alone. When I actually use GNOME 3, the latest version, and I love it, but when they moved from GNOME 2 to 3, a lot of people hated it. GNOME 2 is also the basis for Mate. So that might be another one. In fact, I would maybe try downloading Ubuntu Mate, M-A-T-E.
I've tried Mate, but on a separate computer, and it's very similar, but it doesn't have the same icons, and you'd be lost with it.
Yeah. You can, well, so what you want to do is go through her setup and look at, for instance, what icon set she's using. That's in the theming. And you can get that icon set and put it on Mate or XFCE. You can probably get pretty close.
Okay.
You can probably get pretty close. And I understand your desire to, you know, not change things for her. I think it's fantastic that you got the family using Linux. That's really good.
Yeah.
Because it's more stable. It's not nearly the security problem. Once she's used to using it, it's just as easy to use as anything else, right?
If she were put in front of a Windows computer, she'd be totally lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we started out with Red Hat 2, I think it was, and then it went to Fedora. And that changed too much because I was busy working. And so I went to CentOS.
Yeah. Well, and CentOS is a good choice because it is very much a stable operating system. That's why a lot of servers are running CentOS. But, yes, I can understand why you might want to update it. You're getting pretty old.
I talk with the folks on the SeaMonkey news group. And since that's the only thing that's holding us up, or requiring us to change.
Right.
Can I compile that under
Oh, you could.
You see, it is. And one guy came on and said, forget it. You can't do
that. Oh, that's too bad. So it's just not, it can't be used in a modern operating system. That's too bad. It's hard. This is the hard thing, of course, for everybody. Our brains get, look, it was hard to learn how to use a computer in the first place, right? Or a smartphone or whatever. Our brains develop the neural pathways over long practice so that we can use it. We go, oh, yeah, I know how to use that. And you'll see this happen with geeks. If you have a problem with your computer and you go, can you help me? And they sit down and they go, tap, 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 all done, and walk away. They move so fast because it's built in. It's neural pathways. You have no idea what they did. And if you don't have those neural pathways, it's not much help. But some, you know, I mean, and certainly over time, we get less and less interested in learning new things. I think it's a good thing. I happen to really like learning new things. And I think that that's a valuable trait. But, obviously not everybody agrees. I happen to really like learning new technical skills. Makes me well suited for this job because I've been doing, answering questions about technology for almost 40 years now. And when I first started doing it in the early 90s, it was a very different environment. I wouldn't be surprised if I still have the neural pathways for Windows 3.1. I wouldn't be surprised. I could probably sit right down at that and use it. But doesn't mean I want to stick with it. It's time. It's time to move along. I am a big fan of Linux because it's a free operating system. I think it's better than Windows. I feel like it's not as janky. Microsoft's made so many compromises to keep Windows compatible with old software that it's just really unstable these days and unreliable. And look, every time they update Windows, people complain, oh, you broke things. So I really do. When I get a PC, I put Linux on it. That's the first thing I do. I only have one Windows machine left. And I won't buy a Windows machine unless I can check ahead of time and say, can I put Linux on this when I get tired of Windows 10? Can I? I do. I would say for you, the best Linux for you to try would be Ubuntu Mate or XFCE, which is also very clean, simple, lightweight, and easily customizable. And both of them, I'm pretty sure, use GNOME 2 apps. So all the apps will be similar. She'll be familiar with those. That's nice. The desktop environment is what you see. And that's the other thing I really like about Linux. There are many flavors, not only of distributions. We've talked about a few here. Ubuntu is one, ubuntu.org, or .com, I guess. CentOS is another one. But there are hundreds of Linux distributions. And then on top of that, you run your own desktop environment. There are hundreds of those. So it's very customizable. You can have it be exactly as you want. And a lot of people prefer a form of Linux called Linux Mint because it looks just like Windows. So they don't have to relearn as much. The start menu is in the same spot. The system tray is in the same spot. It doesn't, easily run Windows apps, Microsoft Office and the like. But honestly, the apps like LibreOffice that are available on Linux are so good and so compatible that I don't even think you need to worry about that so much. But you get to choose what cognitive load you embrace. And if the last thing you want to do is waste brain cycles on learning a new computer thing, I don't blame you. I happen to enjoy it. That's why I'm the tech guy. I kind of like it. It's kind of fun for me. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, hour three of the Tech Guy Show. If you're just getting here, oh, you missed some fun. No, you didn't miss anything. All the good stuff's about to happen. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. That would be mean if I said that. 888. Oh, gosh, you just missed two great hours. Oh, man. 888-827-5536. If you're calling from outside the U.S. or Canada, you can still reach us, but you have to use Skype out or something else that'll let you dial a phone number. Shouldn't cost you anything. Still a toll-free number in the U.S. 8888-ASK-LEO. I put in the show notes, I always put everything we talk about. Actually, I don't do anything. James DeRuvo, our scribe, does that. So as I'm talking, James is writing links. Everything's up there, techguylabs.com. And that's nice because it's free. There's no sign up. I'm not going to send you a bunch of spam. I don't even know your email address. I don't need it and I don't want it. Just go there. It's yours, techguylabs.com. We even put audio and video from past shows up there. So if you miss a show, you can go there and see the answers, listen to the answers, watch the answers, whatever works for you. Techguylabs.com. Cameron in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Cameron. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking the call.
Thanks, Cameron.
Okay, say the reason I'm calling. Oh, by the way, you were talking about Windows 3.1.
Oh, yeah.
My first laptop was an IBM machine. It had a 3 or 4 inch dot matrix screen and ran off of 2 3.5 inch floppy disks.
Whoa. It was it about 30 pounds to carry around?
Yeah, pretty much. And I had to learn MS-DOS commands to get this thing running.
Yeah.
Anyways.
You can only see like 3 or 4 lines at a time on the screen, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, wow.
But anyway, I called in about right exactly 2 weeks ago to get a recommendation on a tablet.
Okay.
And I was kind of an Android guy.
Yeah.
But I ended up buying an iPad.
Good man. I talked you into it, huh?
Yeah. Well, two main things that helped. One was I learned that the newest operating iPad can work well with external storage.
Yes.
So the lesser expensive machine, I wouldn't have to really worry about running out of storage.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. Okay. And that's an iPad Pro. You need to have an iPad Pro to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, I guess the newest iPad works on the 10.2. Works on OS 13, which can, I guess, directly read.
Oh, if you have the, you have to have a USB lightning card reader. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I don't know, if you probably can't put apps on that, but all your data can be on it for sure. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But the main thing that took the trigger for me was the day after we talked, the base model, the 32 gig new model, went on sale for $250.
Good price. Yeah, at that price, you'd be crazy to buy an Android device.
No, I tell you what, I am totally loving it.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
One of the first things I did after I got things all set up was opened up. I went to Amazon, opened up like 9 browser windows in Chrome, and it took at most maybe a second or a second and a half to switch back and forth.
Yeah, they're really fast.
It is so nice.
This is why Apple is so anxious to do their own chips. When they know what the operating system is and the applications you're going to run are, they can make highly optimized chips, much more efficient chips than the Intel chips that are designed for anything. So Apple's going to move everything to their custom chips, I think, over the next 3 or 4 years for sure, including Mac OS.
Yeah. Well, I guess I have the A10 processor in this thing, but for my purposes, that is more than
enough. Yeah, absolutely. That's the other thing. I have an iPad Pro, which has the latest processor, but it's nothing demands that much power. They built in way more power than you need, and they do this pretty consistently. Because they can, I guess, because it's a selling point, I guess. Doesn't cost them any more, I guess, but because they don't have to buy it from Intel. So, yeah, you get a lot of horsepower in a modern iPad for sure.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to call to say thank you for making me an Apple convert.
Oh, man, I'm going to get some heat for that. I'm glad you're happy, Cameron. That's fantastic.
Thanks, Leo.
My pleasure. I'm glad to hear back from you, too, because, you know, I tell people to do things. I always get nervous, when somebody calls in and says, Leo, I called a couple of weeks ago. You told me to do this. I always think, oh, they're going to yell at me now. It usually works out, though. Thank goodness. You can yell at me, too. It's fine. Steve on the line from Winfield, West Virginia. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Leo. How are you, sir?
Great. Welcome. How are you?
Good. Listen, I'm doing wonderful.
Good.
You have a sensei for photos, but you are my tech sensei.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So I am generally a Linux user, but I am forced to use Windows for my church live stream.
Yes, that's not unusual. And do you have some special worship software that you use or?
No, what we're using right now is, on your recommendation, actually, the Blackmagic A10s.
Nice. Okay. Nice.
And
Wow.
An Optics Pro PTZ Optics camera.
Are you doing a 4K stream of church services?
No. Just 1080.
Nice.
Here's my problem. I've got the church computer, church laptop is old, and it will not output a signal to the ATEMs through the HDMI. Okay. That doesn't have the right resolution.
Right.
But we are also going to try to use that computer to go through VGA out to our two projectors for the PowerPoint.
Okay.
So I need a laptop that will output a signal to the ATEMs as well as the same signal to the projectors, but I'm pretty sure they're going to be on different resolutions.
So the projector needs analog VGA.
Right.
And the ATEM is looking for HDMI out. The ATEM, A-T-E-M, I should mention, is a switcher, a camera switcher, kind of like you'd see in a TV station, except it's a little thing. It's only $300. It has four HDMI inputs. It has two audio inputs and allows you to switch between them and has all sorts of fun things you can do. Perfect for a church because you don't need more than four cameras probably.
Right now we only have one camera and I want to hook up the PowerPoint.
Sure.
So that I can show
the hymns.
Worships and that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually surprised that the laptop doesn't work, except that it sounds like it only has analog out, and that's probably the issue. You could probably get a converter that would take VGA to turn it into digital HDMI.
But with the PowerPoint going out, sometimes we have embedded video, especially right now during coronavirus. We can't be spraying our droplets out over.
No droplets allowed. Let's get that choir. Get that choir behind glass. So there is one of my studio engineers is telling me this might be a cheaper thing for you than buying a new laptop. Although if you want to buy a new laptop, I'll tell you how to do that. Sometimes people call and they just want an excuse.
Authorized to spend up to $600.
Okay. So, almost any modern laptop will do this. The problem is VGA is analog, HDMI is digital. And nothing will do both. You know, that's unusual. So Burke is recommending something from the Cloner Alliance, cloner-alliance.com, called the Cloner Box Pro. And it apparently will do both HDMI and VGA. So I'm looking because I don't know if it's a standalone. Oh, it's a video capture box. So this is what you would need to take the existing laptop and get its video into the ATEM Mini. It would convert the VGA out of the laptop into HDMI that you could plug into the back of the ATEM.
Yeah, but now the VGA will not allow audio.
Oh, and you want audio coming into the ATEM as well.
Yeah, because, we have our doxology that is...
Right. So you want to play the music's coming through. You know, okay, got it. All right. Almost any laptop nowadays would do the HDMI, and then so you'd have to go the other direction, which is get an HDMI to VGA converter.
Yeah.
Although Burke is saying that the Cloner Alliance Box Pro does have audio in... So it could mix it down, take the VGA from the laptop, and then take the audio from the laptop, mix it down into the HDMI so that both would end up in the box. And the ATEM Mini, the nice thing about this, in this case, is lip sync isn't critical, I presume, so it doesn't matter if there's a little lag one way or the other. So that's one way to do it. Any laptop, though, will do HDMI. They all do nowadays. So you just need an HDMI to VGA converter to go the other direction.
Yeah, that's been my problem. I have not been able to find a laptop that has VGA because
no, they won't.
It goes so thin.
That's right. So you need an adapter.
Yeah.
So and there are plenty of these. They're cheap. It takes the HDMI and turns it into VGA, which you could then send to your projector.
Right. We can also go through USB-C, I would imagine.
Well, again, that's digital. So this is why you don't see both.
Well, I mean, USB-C to VGA.
Yeah.
On that side.
Yes, they make those.
Leave my HDMI out to the ATEMs.
I'm sure they make. Let me just check USB-C. I'm sure they do. To VGA. VGA is an old, very old analog standard. Yes, 1256. It's a USB-C to VGA adapter, and it would take it out of the MacBook Pro, but it would also take it out of any other modern computer, a Surface Go, a Samsung phone. takes that USB-C video, turns it into an analog VGA signal that you suitable for your projector.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's worth getting a new laptop if you've got the budget for it and they don't mind you spending it. It certainly would be faster. It's just that the modern laptops don't output analog anymore. They only output digital.
Yeah, the laptop that we have is almost 10 years old.
Yeah, it's probably time for a new one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's time for a new one. Yeah. Right.
Hey, I'm so glad you're doing this. Are you the pastor or are you just doing this for fun?
No, I'm not the pastor. I have a different calling. I'm a teacher.
Nice. But you're also their tech guy.
But I'm their tech guy, yes.
That's nice. You know what? Everybody needs one.
You're absolutely right. I have been watching you since Tech TV and the screensavers, and so I really appreciate your help.
I'm so glad, Steve. Have a wonderful Sunday.
Thank you. You too.
Take care. My pleasure. Yeah, nowadays, it's funny because, of course, for a long time there have been churches with fairly sophisticated AV setups. But nowadays, every church, even small churches, they want to stream. You know, they don't want to make congregants come in and risk getting sick. So they want to stream. You know, I think after we're all better and everything's fine and you can go back to church, I think you'll still want to stream. As people are older or they're ill or for whatever reason they can't make it to church, it's wonderful to be able to offer that. And, this is the best part about this is because of YouTube and services like YouTube, Twitch, Mixer, you can do this for free. When we first started the podcast network, Twit, 15 years ago, and then we started doing video, it's expensive to offer video streams. You got to pay a service. The more people that watch, the more expensive it really adds up. But I was often worried that this would be, an expense we couldn't really bear. You know, we were an audio network, but people wanted to watch. So I did video and I thought, at some point, these companies are going to go away and we're not going to have a free service or we're going to not have a cheap service. We're going to have to start paying through the nose. It went the other way completely. YouTube streams live for free. Twitch streams live for free. Mixer from Microsoft streams live for free. And that's just a few of them. Live streaming is easy. It's free. You only need an inexpensive box. You don't need fancy cameras. There's no reason why a church or synagogue or mosque shouldn't put its services online. I think that's great. Our show today, the podcast brought to you by LastPass. Here we are in the beautiful LastPass studio. And, of course, I love LastPass. I've used it for so long. I think, when did they come out? It's been more than 10 years. I was using a different password manager. Immediately when I read about LastPass, I said, wow, this works on iOS. This works on Android. This works on Windows. This works on Mac. This works on Linux. That's for me, baby. And, of course, later we got Steve Gibson to take a look at how they do it. He talked to the founder, Joe Segrist. Joe showed him that they did everything right and Steve, our security guy, gave him thumbs up. He said, this is great. He started using it, still does. I still do. We even use LastPass at work now. It started as a password manager and the best password manager there is. But from the point of view of the enterprise, of business, it's so much more. Of course, it is an enterprise-grade password management tool. It gives you shadow IT oversight. It gives you enforceable policies across all the password-protected accounts. If you've got workers at home right now, you're going to be so glad you're using LastPass. It's not too late, by the way. You can get LastPass up and running, provision it super fast. You'd have it done by the end of the day. And the thing I think it's really important to tell IT is your employees will actually appreciate it. They'll love it because they'll know not only are they more secure, but LastPass makes it easier for them. Nobody likes passwords. Nobody does. And your employees, if you're not using LastPass right now, they're writing them down. They're putting them on Post-it notes. They're sharing them with friends. they're, you know, this is a hard thing. And they're not making up good passwords. They're using the same password over and over. That just makes your company vulnerable. LastPass secures your company across every password point, every access point. And they do it not just with passwords. They now have single sign-on apps, which I loved, over 1,200 plus single sign-on apps supported by LastPass. The employees love that because they don't have to use passwords at all. They open up a program. It says click OK on your phone. That's it. It's more secure. From your point of view, it's a 10 times better solution. From their point of view, it's a lot easier. Security doesn't have to mean less convenient. That's what I learned from LastPass. They also add multi-factor authentication. And, you know, of course, your LastPass vault is protected. And we always insist on, it's one of the password policies we enforce, using two-factor. All our employees do. But that two-factor can be your face, can be your fingerprint with biometric authentication. LastPass works with that. It can also be contextual factors. And this is a way that LastPass ensures, in addition to the biometric, ensures that the right people are using your resources, your bank accounts, your websites, your data, all that stuff you really got to keep close to the vest. LastPass's contextual multi-factor includes a number of things, but among a couple are geolocation, IP address, all of this to make sure the right people are using the right resources, right? And your IT department has a centralized view at all times so they can see who has access to what, where they are. Really, it's reassuring. It's hugely reassuring. And you'll also be glad to know LastPass does everything right. That's what Steve Gibson verified. For instance, your master password is trust no one. Only you have access to the master password. It's never transmitted. LastPass does not have access to it. That means hackers can't get access to it. The encryption and decryption happens exclusively on the device, whether it's a phone or a laptop or a desktop. It doesn't happen anywhere else. The only data that's being sent in the LastPass password vault is fully encrypted with AES 256, super strong, military-grade encryption. It does everything right. And that's really what you want to know. LastPass protects you, protects your company, and, yeah, nice, makes your employees happy. It's a seamless workflow for them. It's more security for you. You're going to love LastPass. If you've got a remote workforce and you haven't started using it, please do. If you're using a VPN, for instance, LastPass can make that more secure by adding biometrics to it. Oh, and employees can share passwords, not, you know, by sending, mailing something or calling somebody up, but instantly using LastPass and securely. So, again, another great feature. Just visit LastPass.com/twit. Check it out. Find out how they can help your business stay both productive and secure no matter what happens, even from home. LastPass, I'm so glad we use it. I'm so glad. It made it so much easier. LastPass.com/twit. LastPass.com/twit. Thank you, LastPass, for keeping Twit on the air, for supporting our company. Thank you, dear listener, for supporting the podcast by using that special address so they know you saw it here. LastPass.com/twit. Now, on with the show. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. Timmy, Oak Hills, California is next. Hi, Timmy.
Hey, Leo. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks, as always. Hey, this is interesting sequence of callers you've had. I'm calling in with a simple Android tablet question. But
okay.
One of your callers also maybe ask a second question if time permits. And
sure.
I also have a suggestion.
Yeah.
For all this screen VGA stuff at the end, if time permits.
Holy cow. Okay, go.
Yeah, well, God bless you. Thank you for all your help all the time. First one is, I give music lessons out of my house here. I just have a couple simple RCA Android tablets.
Yeah.
And I did a little research with frustration. Is there any way that I can hook up my tablet when I have an app for, like, music lessons up to a big screen TV?
Ooh, wouldn't that be nice so everybody could see it?
Right.
Yeah.
And it seems like so simple, but I did research and I...
Easiest way to do that, and it really is dependent on the software you're using, is with Google's Chromecast capability.
Uh-huh.
You got a little Chromecast dongle for your TV. They're $30 to $50.
I see.
And then you have to have the Chromecast capability. What app do you use for the music teaching? Is it just a website? If it's a website, you're good.
It's an actual Android app. It's from a company called... Well, this is just... my main one. I use several, but just for an example, it's relatively new. It's from a company called Positive Grid.
Yeah, I bet you they don't have Chromecast capability. You'd know if there's a little icon in the corner. It's Netflix and Amazon Prime and stuff like that that have the Chromecast so that you can start those movies up on your tablet and then watch them on your big screen TV. It's certainly possible for these companies to put Chromecast in. I would check with them to see if they put that capability in, but I'm going to guess it's not there.
I see, because I saw on some of the new Samsung phones, it looks like there's a wired capability.
Yeah, you can get HDMI out of them. Yeah, what kind of connector is there on that RCA tablet? Is it a mini?
One of them. There's a USB.
Micro USB.
And there's the smaller kind of a ubiquitous USB, the micro or mini.
Yeah.
That sometimes are used for data.
No video on that. Yeah.
And I tried one that supposedly it converted that small USB with a micro or mini.
Those inexpensive HDMI tablets are probably not going to have.
Yeah,
video out. Yeah. If you had Type C on it, as the Samsungs do, they can send video out. Then it's just a question of putting that capability into the tablet. But, you know, these RCA tablets are not expensive. I doubt very much they've done that.
Okay. Well, that's no big deal. They're very, very reasonable prices, like $85.
Yeah, they're a good price. If you bought a Samsung tablet or even a Samsung phone, you'd be able to do this. A great idea. Ask the company if they have Chromecast. It's easy to build in. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I didn't get to your other two parts. We ran out. But go ahead. We're still on the podcast.
Okay, real good. Yeah, I did hang on. The second one is one of your previous calls was talking about, you know, and you're such a promoter of Linux. I'm going to look forward to learning more about that. I do have one hard drive that I'm going to start to learn on.
Good.
Going back to that tablet thing, can I actually, are there some apps or some things that I can use on an Android tablet to almost use it as a laptop computer?
No. Again, not for the $85 RCA tablet. If you got a Samsung, yes, because they have video out of the bottom.
Gotcha.
And in fact, Samsung does this with their phones, the technology called DeX, D-E-X, that lets you hook it up to a keyboard, mouse, and monitor using a special dongle. They're cheap. And then you've got a computer off your phone because the phone's powerful enough. Yeah, I don't think RCA, especially if it has micro USB out, they're not going to have that capability.
No, real quick, I'm just talking about just my RCA has a detachable keyboard. So it looks like a little Chromebook, 11.5-inch. I just wondering if there's apps like for Office that I could run like an Office.
Yeah, what I recommend is instead of running an app on it, use the web browser and use Google Docs.
Okay. And in that sense, kind of make it like a little bit of a Office app.
That's how Chromebooks work, yeah. Chromebooks, they don't have an Office product on the Chromebook. You're expected to use Google Docs, which have a PowerPoint equivalent, a Word equivalent, an Excel equivalent. They do it all. They have all of the tools. And actually, they do it better. And then they don't store it. The problem with that RCA, you don't have much storage on it. But
right, I got 32 gigs, but I have 128 chip in there, the SD card.
Yeah, I would use the Google Cloud to store it, and that's the advantage of Google Drive. You're storing in the cloud, so you have unlimited storage, effectively.
And thanks for time. I got one last suggestion, if you have a second.
Sure.
I know the gentleman wanted to convert HDMI to VGA, I think, but I run three monitors here in my office where I do the lessons and stuff, and one of them, two of the monitors, I just run off the USB ports with, I think it's a company called like UVGA.
Yes,
It transfers to VGA.
That's right.
What I just found, I just bought a 32-inch monitor for my larger monitor that goes along with my laptop, and I use the VGA out of the laptop, and it just has two cables besides the connector with VGA. One plugs into the speaker out of the laptop for audio. And the other one just is into USB.
That's right.
That powers the converter, and they're only like $8.
Yeah, they're cheap.
So for what it's worth, I'm sure you know it all, but I thought I'd throw that in there just in case.
Yeah, that's actually what I was telling them to get, basically.
Yeah. They're so inexpensive.
They're not expensive.
It actually gives my TV better resolution than if I go VGA.
That's interesting. I guess that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, because when I go VGA to VGA, the best I can get is 1,200 by whatever it is.
Right.
1,200 by 700, whatever that is. But I can get up to 1,600 by 1,200 using the VGA of the laptop with that HDMI converter.
Do you teach an instrument, or what do you teach?
Yeah, I teach bass and guitar and a little bit of keyboards, but, you know, depending on if they're beginners.
Do you have students coming in now, or are you kind of having to wait till all this is over?
I mostly it's friends and family that I know, so I just do one-on-one, and we just make sure we're safe. But I've done some stuff on Skype. I haven't tried Zoom yet. Haven't needed to. But my buddy that gives drum lessons, he teaches by Zoom.
That's awesome. That's really awesome.
Well, we learned it from you. It's been great.
Well, the other thing that's great, and I keep telling you, I take Pilates by Zoom, or actually by FaceTime, and I keep telling my instructor, you know, now you have a national clientele. Because they don't have to be in your town to come over to learn the bass. You could teach anybody anywhere in the world. It suddenly opens up huge horizons for you.
Well, again, it goes right along with you told that gentleman at the church. Now that when people start coming back,
keep doing it.
That doesn't mean you have to stop.
Keep doing it.
Do them both.
Yeah. I think we're all learning some skills that are going to be useful. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Hey, it's great to talk to you.
Thanks again for your time, Leo. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for calling. Take care, Timmy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I think Lady Laura heard me earlier trying to do my Michael Jackson falsetto, and she had to show me the way with little earth, wind, and fire. 8888, Ask Leo. Last half hour of the show. Let's see what trouble we can wrestle up here. On the line from Wikiwachi, Florida, Tim. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Leo. Got a question about Android with the screens burning in. You know what? They want to put the status there, leave it bright white.
And it's always there, huh?
It's always there. You know how the phones have like a test pattern where you can look at all the pixels? You look at red, green, and blue?
Yeah.
The red ones never burn in. The red phosphor is very stable.
Yeah.
But there's no way to go into Android and say, look, make that top display red only.
I wish. You
know, I didn't know there was a trick. I didn't know.
There might be a way to do it if you use a custom launcher. See, many launchers have a lot of customizations. You're using what phone are you using?
I got a Samsung A20.
Okay. For instance, I'm using right now a launcher I really like called Active Launcher. I think I'm using Active Launcher. And the status bar on my Android is actually clear. So I just see the information, but there is no white bar at all. It's just the wallpaper in the background. But yeah, that's also fully customizable. I mean, you're never, you know, the default launchers, the Samsung launcher, may not have that customizability. But if you download...
That's a launcher thing.
Yeah, it's in the launcher, exactly. So if you download another launcher, I'm using, as I said, Active Launcher, which I really like. There's something called Lawn Chair. Get it? Pun. Mm-hmm. There's Nova Launcher, which I like a lot. Almost all of these have theming. They have things that you can do to change to customize it. And one of the things absolutely in the theme would be to change that status bar. You can even turn it off completely in Active Launcher and have no status bar at all. I mean, I happen to think that's useful, but that's one way to get rid of it. I'm sorry it's burning in like that. If it's a Samsung phone, it's probably an OLED screen.
Well, I got a new phone. That's why. And it's like, you know, all my other phones, I'm looking at them. And it's like, oh, this is burned in there.
Yeah, that's too bad.
A year or two later. And it's like, oh, here we go with another phone again. It's going to get burned in again.
Yeah. I never use the default Samsung launcher. I mean, I know it's the easiest to use. This is a Pixel phone. I'm not using Google's Pixel launcher either. I almost always install a different launcher. Not because of the burn-in. I've actually never had burn-in. I'm kind of surprised to hear that. But just because I like to customize it a lot more than the stock launchers will do. I'm going to put – somebody in the chat room has – put a link from a site I've never heard of called Android Pit. It's not a good name, but on how to handle burn-in on an AMOLED or LCD display. There are some things you can do.
I was thinking they should have some kind of pixel tracker where they could count, you know, in the background, like how long each pixel has been and run them at 80%, and over time maybe.
They recommend a program for OLED called OLED Tools. It's in the Google Play Store. It'll sequence through colors. The theory is it's going to restore burned-in colors, and there's also one for LCDs called LCD Burn-In Wiper. I'm guessing, I don't remember the AA, but almost all Samsung phones are OLED these days.
Yeah, I looked at them. All they do is they blast all the pixels at brightness for a while.
Yeah, they try to juice them up. Yeah. It may not fix it. I mean, burn-in's burn-in, but I have not seen a lot of burn-in on OLEDs, though. That's why I'm surprised to hear about it, but they can occur in theory.
It's the blue and the green layer. It's like when we had those old analog yellow screens or green screens.
Yep.
And you could see what everybody left.
Yeah, those were burning. Oh, man, yeah. If you looked at a terminal like at an airport or something that's been on for the same screen for years, you could turn the screen off, still read it.
Yeah.
That's burning.
I went back to the Commodore 64s and Sinclairs, and my trash 80 was the one that had the ribbon cable out of it that every time you wiggled it, reboot.
Oh, I remember those. There were a series of them that were so sensitive to static electricity that if you rubbed your feet on the carpet and then touched the keyboard, you'd kill it. You'd actually kill the computer. That's a fun joke to play on friends and family.
My friend's mom worked at Ward's, and every time we hooked stuff up to the Commodore and burned it out, she'd exchange it for us.
Oh, Lord. Those are the days. Those are the days.
Thanks a lot for your help, Lou.
My pleasure. I'm glad you called. I appreciate it. I honestly, one of the main reasons I like Android, in fact, really pretty much the only reason, is unlike the iPhone, you can change your home screen. You can change what your screen looks like. The iPhone, you're stuck. It's what they called Springboard. Apple calls it Springboard. There are rumors, we'll find out a week from Monday, that they're going to allow us to customize a little more on iOS 14. I hope that rumor is true. Because as you know, if you look at my, someday I'll post all this, but if you look at my Android screen, it's got widgets of widgets and widgets. And it's, you know, it's highly customized. I use Spring folders, loaded folders, so that I only see one icon on the screen. But if I swipe down on that icon, I could see all the icons under it. There's a lot of nice things you can do with Android phones, thanks to the fact that you could put in any launcher you want. I think that's a nice feature. Apple's avoided that since 2007. Maybe they're going to change it. I hope so. Bill in Austin, Texas is next. Hi, Bill. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello.
Hey, welcome.
Hi, I've got a question. Do you have any suggestions on how to speed up the boot times after a person has installed Windows 10 May update 2004?
So you have 2004 on there and your boot time is really slow?
Right. I get a black screen initially and then it takes about 5 minutes for the icons to load.
Oh, is this now 2004 just came out? And apparently this is not an unusual thing. I'm seeing lots of complaints about this, even on Microsoft's own forum. I'm looking and see, it says Windows booting very slow after 2004 update. I'm not sure why. Anytime you update a computer, you're kind of shaking it to the bones. It could very well be, and I have to say Microsoft has a terrible track record in this regard, that this update wasn't sufficiently tested and is causing a problem on your computer and other computers like it, that they should have caught in the public beta. For some reason, they didn't, but there's a lot of problems like that. It could be that just the effect that you installed new software challenged the hard drive enough that it's gotten very slow. This is very common on hard drives, of course. This is how they wear out. They don't die usually. They just get slower and slower as they get harder and harder to read. The operating system has to work harder and harder and harder.
Well, I've got a 1 terabyte Samsung SSD drive.
No, yeah, that shouldn't be doing it. In fact, that should boot very nice and quick. I would say Google this. I see I'm on a support Microsoft support site where people are saying this exact problem. I don't see a fix. But I see some things you can try. You know, they're recommending the system file checker tool, SFC. Yeah, maybe. They're recommending the online cleanup. Or yeah, maybe. I mean, these are the standard kind of things that Microsoft will always tell you. I don't know. It could also be that the driver for that drive got messed up or got downgraded to an old one. I would go into your BIOS, update your BIOS. I would go into Plug and Play. I would actually go into the Device Manager, look at all the devices, particularly at the hard drives, make sure that there's no yellow exclamation mark or red X. Maybe, okay. I don't know. I honestly, one of the reasons I've given up on Windows is because these updates break so many things so often. It's very frustrating. I would check to see if Samsung has an updated firmware for their drive. That may be another thing. You do have, in effect, a new operating system on there, a big update. And it could be that you know, they need a new driver. Samsung might have a fix for you. So frustrating. That's ridiculous. Nothing should take 5 minutes to boot, especially with an SSD.
Yeah. Can I give you some more information?
Sure.
That is strange. My wife has an account on the computer, and her account boots fast and normal.
Ah.
It's only my account.
Ah.
The administrator. The other thing is that I've got Office 2019 installed, but when I start my Office applications, it gives me the splash screen for Office 365.
Yeah.
But when I go in to check the account, it says Office 2019 and that it's activated.
Yeah, that's I think that's normal. I think that's Microsoft. In fact, it's at some point going to stop saying Office 365. It's going to start saying Microsoft 365. So there's the subscription, which is mm-hmm. Office 365, soon to be Microsoft 365. And then there's the actual software, which is Word 2019. And so I think that's okay. I do think it's very telling that your profile, different profiles have different boot times. My guess is that you have something that you're loading in your profile that is on a part of the drive that's hard to read. That's the only thing I can think of. Because it's not that the boot is slow or that the hard drive is bad, because your wife is perfectly normal.
Right.
So it's something that's unique to your profile. That means software, basically. It could even mean the profile settings, things like that. If they're on a bad sector, doesn't mean the drive's going bad, but they're on a bad sector. What happens, Windows keeps trying to read it, and you're waiting while that happens. And if there's enough of those, that can happen. One thing you might do is create a new profile for yourself, new administrator profile. If you can't move some of your stuff over, whatever you need.
That's what I was planning to try.
And then if you have enough hard drive space, that's one thing you can do. My friend Steve Gibson's SpinRite would probably be useful in this regard. The problem is it's $90. A new drive is not much more. But if you really wanted to see, running SpinRite on this drive would probably find those. What it does is it finds those sectors that are slow or hard to read and relocates mm-hmm. that data. And that almost always fixes problems like this. You might have a ton of fonts. Somebody's saying, what if he has 10,000 fonts on his account? It could be. Look at the things that are different about your account.
The only thing that I think is noticeably different is that I've got the iTunes account under my account, the iTunes library. But that's about it.
Yeah. Well, it could be trying to load those indexes takes forever. Does iTunes load automatically on boot?
No.
Okay. So a couple of things you can do. There is a program Microsoft offers. It's part of its sysinternals called Auto Runs. You can see what's starting up that might be different in your system than hers. I bet you there is something different. That might be what's holding you up. It's called Auto Runs. It's free.
Well, what about going into the system settings and checking the startup
menus? Check the startup menus. Try starting in safe mode. See if your profile loads fast in safe mode. If it does, then it is probably something in the startup that's loading.
Okay.
There's a few things you can look at. It's actually a huge information that your wife doesn't have this problem. That's actually a relief because it means it's not a bad Windows install. It's something unique to you.
It's a relatively new computer, and it's still under warranty
They'll take out. That's a long process. I would try a few of these things yourself. Don't do anything destructive, but some of these things are worth working on, I think. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thank you to Lady Laura, our musical director, once again taking us back to a time before she was born. She knows she's working for an old man, so he likes it. That old man goes, yeah, that's good old stuff. Thank you, too, to Kim Schaffer, who has done a great job getting some calls on the air, getting your calls on the air. I appreciate it, Kim. Thanks to you for listening. Couldn't do this show if somebody didn't listen to it. The radio station just say, well, go home, Leo. Nobody's listening. So thank goodness somebody is. Thank you for calling. Thank you for participating. And thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. Let's get a few more in before the end of the line here. I think we have time. We'll go into Warren, Rhode Island. And Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing, Leo?
I am fantastic. How are you?
Well, I'm laid up a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
What I have a question on is my Chromebook is expiring this month, and
yeah, I really hate this that Google does this. They don't update Chrome OS for more than a few years, and that's to me not nice. How old is that Chromebook?
It's about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. So it'll keep running and it will probably be completely functional. You just won't get the latest version of Chrome. I don't know if you need it. There's potentially some security risks, but not really, because Chromebooks are so secure to begin with. There aren't very many bad things that can happen to you. So it's just like any operating system. Expiration doesn't mean that's it, you can't use it anymore. It means we're not going to update it anymore. And I honestly think that you're probably just fine. So as long as you're happy with it, I'd keep using it. I should point out there are great Chromebooks out now. They're getting better and better. Well, you know, when you got that 5 years ago, maybe it was a little bit a question mark. Is Chromebook going to take off? But in those 5 years, it absolutely has. And a lot of that's because of education. Schools all over the country, all over the world use Chromebooks in classrooms. But I think also I've been recommending it for years because it's more secure, it's safer. And for most of what people do on a computer, it's perfect. So I wouldn't feel obligated to get a new one if you're happy with it. On the other hand, if you feel like you want a new one, there's some excellent ones. Google's making something called the Chromebook Go that's very nice. A little pricey because it's Google. Acer makes really nice Chromebooks, I think, some of the best in the business. And the price range is anywhere from $250 to, well, you could spend as much as $1,000 on a high-end Chromebook, but you probably don't need that. I would take a look at some of the aluminum Acer Chromebooks, $300 for the 315. It's a decent processor, nice big screen, 15-inch screen, 4 gigs of RAM, that's plenty, 32 gigs of storage. It's a great price. They have, of course, their high-end product, the Chromebook Spin. That's a little more like $700 or more. But they have some very nice choices. I would absolutely look at the Acers. Samsung makes great Chromebooks. In fact, a lot of people love the new Samsung Chromebook. It's bright red, which makes it pretty sexy. Yeah, if you're laid up, having that laptop is important.
Yes, yeah.
So
it's just very annoying that it chose this time.
The time you need it the most. Well, like I said, right. It should still operate. It's not going to, and it's not even really, unlike Windows, you don't want to use Windows XP or Windows 7. There's so many security issues. An expired version of Windows, expired Chrome OS, I don't think that's such a big deal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I would continue to use it until you get to the point where you go to websites and they say, I'm sorry, your version of Chrome is too old. That's years off.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing you're missing, the version of Chrome. You know, you don't get to get the Chrome updates. Big deal.
But it still should be fairly secure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Banking.
Yeah.
And that type of stuff.
Yeah, that's why you got that. That thing is secure. Right. And if anything goes wrong, you still have the power wash. It'll get it back to the latest version that you've got, completely clean. I love that feature. Yeah, no, I wouldn't worry about it. Now's not the time. If you're laid up, you probably don't want to spend any money on a new Chromebook. So just, Bob, it's fine. Keep using it. Nothing to get scared about.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah.
But still may want to go to order something from Best Buy and just get something a little bigger.
Absolutely. They're faster now. They have more RAM. I'm a big fan of the Galaxy Chromebook. They have a bright red one, $550. Good processor, lots of storage. an unusually large amount of storage. You don't need that much in a Chromebook. And a really nice screen. Samsung makes beautiful screens. There are lots of good choices out there. And they and Samsung includes a pen with theirs. So that's nice. You have the touch interface. So there'll be some improvements because yours is fairly old. They'll definitely be faster and, you know, have some nice new features like touch. You can you'll be able to use the Android store. Actually, frankly, that's the bigger security risk is the Android store. Google does a lot to protect you from it. They sandbox all the Android apps. So that really expands what you can do with a Chromebook. That might be one reason to look at it. But don't worry about the not getting updates. That's fine. It's nice to talk to you. I hope you feel better soon. Sorry that this is not a good time to be laid up, isn't it? Or maybe it is. I guess if you're going to pick a time, a good time to be laid up when no one else is going anywhere either. You're not missing any fun. Let's put it that way, Bob. Last call of the day. Dave from Los Angeles. Hi, Dave.
Well, hi, Leo. Glad to glad you're shooting me in.
Well, yeah, I am glad I did, too.
Well, I got a question. Back when I was a kid, a teenager, back in the 70s, you know, you had Radio Shack and Tandy. And,
yeah.
And so these computers, okay, so-called computers. And they had a bunch of toggle switches, and you throw the switches.
Yeah, yeah. Did you remember Heath kits? Did you ever do a Heath kit?
That was another thing I remember, too.
Those were the days. Yeah.
I never had one myself, okay? My initiation to computers was a Xerox 860 word processor in the Navy, which is 10 years later.
Yeah.
But in any case, My question is, okay, so you got the switches, and you throw them one way, and you get a bunch of lights, and they went this way, you throw the switches another way, and you get another bunch of lights.
I got one right behind me.
What's the whole point behind it?
What's the point? Well, remember, this comes from a time when you and I were young, when computers... In the 70s, what a computer meant is a giant IBM or Burroughs thing in a specially air-conditioned room somewhere where, you know, the priesthood of the computer nerds could operate it. And if you were lucky, you'd get a timeshare terminal. You could log into it, or maybe you'd bring them your punch card. So the whole idea of a small personal computer in the 70s was really limited. We didn't really have microprocessors. So, and we didn't have screens. So the one behind me is a replica of something called a PDP-11. It's running a Raspberry Pi, a $35 computer that's about a million times faster than a PDP-11. But the switches were how you would load in the first program, the so-called bootloader, that would then let you use a paper tape or a cassette or some other device to load in a bigger program. It was a small program. And, you know, didn't have firmware, so you had to use those switches to get in at first. And those lights would tell you you were doing it right. The lights tell you what registers are loading, what activities are going on. Instead of a screen and a keyboard, you had that, those lights and switches. Those were the days, my friend. We've come a long way, baby. Hey, thank you for the calls. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know what I say every week? I mean it. Have a safe geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T, it stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.